Putting the Scat in Eschatology. It's the Drew Marshall Show.
All three brothers love their father, and he's brought them here today to see these papers and these lawyers. Divide the old estate. All three feel that they're the favorite. He loves each of them the best. And these documents he gave them will now put them to the test. So they open all the writings that will prove the rightful heir to this home that they remember and the right to settle there. Their own sister is a prisoner.
This is one of my most favorite songs by American singer-songwriter David Wilcox. He parallels the story of three brothers who are sit down to discuss their father's inheritance, and each one of the brothers thinks that they're going to get it all. And when the will is opened up and reviewed, it's true. Each of them gets it all. And the boundaries overlap. And it's confusing. And they're not sure what to do. And this song contrasts, you know, that story with the story of Jerusalem. You know, this rock that has these three monotheistic beliefs that have landed on it. And in this song, there's a character, Faith, which is the sister, I believe. It's such a great song. Have a little bit more of a listen, and then we'll be right with you with Karen Armstrong.
Studies what he has shown. They hold their maps that show possession. To this place they've called their home. First they sigh with satisfaction when they see what's on their maps. Each one's given all he wanted, but the boundaries overlap. So do you wish us to be brothers? Father, help us understand. Will we each kill off the others to claim this same piece of land? Do you mean there to be hatred in this place you built to last? And will Faith just die a prisoner in the dungeon of the past? She lives behind those bars of steel and waits for her release. Will she die, or will
Well, folks, Karen Armstrong is one of the world's leading authorities on the subject of religion and author of the best-selling works, History of God, Islam, Case for God. And she's addressed the British House of Parliament, the U.S. Congress, the World Economic Summit, and is an ambassador for the United Nations Alliance for Civilizations. In 2008, she was awarded the TED Prize and used it to create the Charter for Compassion, a global initiative for peace. In her latest book, Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence, Ms. Armstrong has finally written a work focused on the contentious relationship between religion and the violence that so many people associate with Islam, Judaism, Christianity. And one of the chief arguments leveled against religion is that it is intrinsically violent. Of course, Richard Dawkins wrote, only the willfully blind could fail to implicate the divisive force of religion in most, if not all, of the violent enmities in the world today. Karen Armstrong advocates for a more nuanced view, of course, In this sweeping new work, she traces human history back to our earliest civilizations and employs an in-depth comparison across all religions. What she uncovers tells us much about how humanity developed and throws out the overly simplified view that religion is violent by nature. She joins us today. Ms. Armstrong, lovely to chat with you.
And you too.
I guess the first thing I want to go to is happy birthday last week.
Thank you very much.
Was turning 70 weird for you at all? How did you celebrate it?
Well, I was working hard. The publishers keep me very hard at work. It's a form of slave labor.
Yeah.
Somebody told me that after this tour, I'll be equipped to write a book on modern slavery.
Nice, nice. But did you have family or friends? Or did you do any kind of celebratory thing at all?
The night before my birthday, I had dinner with my agent in San Francisco. And then the next day, I went off to Santa Cruz.
Well, that's nice. That's a nice area.
Very nice.
Yeah.
And I had the day after my birthday free so I could sit and watch the surf.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
It was beautiful.
You know, people always remember how you finish. Of course, you just ask Bill Cosby these days, if that's the scenario. And allow me to be a tad macabre at the start of this interview, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
If you knew that 80 was as long as you were going to live and that people remember how you finish, what would you like to be remembered for?
I think I'd like to be remembered for, as a peacemaker, someone who's trying to muddy some of the oversimplistic certainties that are abroad in one time so that we get a more accurate picture of our very perilous predicament at this moment.
Okay, now that's something you've been doing forever. In these next 10 years, in this next decade, do you plan on changing gears at all or ramping it up a notch, doing something different?
At the moment, I'm like somebody who's just had a baby. I've just produced this book, and now I'm publicizing it. But I have a glimmering idea for the conception of the next one, which will be, I think, about embodiment, the fact that we live in bodies, the fact that how does that fit in with our spirituality, and also looking at the problem of death and dying.
Wow. So you're already on to the next child.
I'm thinking about it. It's still a twinkle in my eye.
Of all of your books, now that we've talked about it in this way, of all of your books, which one do you think is the middle child?
The middle child? What do you mean by that?
Well, the one that just never got enough attention.
I think probably that would be The Great Transformation.
Okay.
Which I loved writing and which was a seminal book for me. It did nicely, but I always felt it could have done a bit better in the polls, as it were. But it was a very formative book for me because it showed me definitively how central the notion of compassion is to all the great world religions. The golden rule, never treat others as you would not like to be treated yourself. Or as Confucius put it, do not impose on others which you yourself do not desire. And I became convinced, really, that as a result of writing that book, that unless now we implement that golden rule globally so that we ensure that as far as we can, that all peoples are treated as we would wish to be treated ourselves, the world will not be a viable place. I have a sense of urgency about this.
Apparently, yeah. Well, that's fantastic. Okay, look, I was a member of a cast for a reality documentary filmed in Israel for a month a few years ago, And of course, this week's attacks at the synagogue in Jerusalem, you know, the impact that ISIS has had on the world as of late, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we really could go on and on about the nonsense going on over there.
Mm-hmm.
If Karen Armstrong was able to get the key Palestinian leaders and the key Jewish leaders on, say, maybe a Karen Armstrong Charter for Compassion retreat weekend, what would you focus on? What would you say? What exercises would you have them do? I mean, how would you drive peace and compassion into their souls?
I think, first of all, I'd make them look at their origins, look where they came from. Because I think unless we have a good sense of our own past and of other people's past, we're not likely to make much sense of the present. And if you look at Zionism, for example, this sprang out of the fact that nationalism was the new enthusiasm in the West. Nationalism had become a sort of a new sacred value. And our nationalism is imbued with religious fervor. You know, when we sing our national anthems, our hearts swell, we feel that we are swept up in something greater than ourselves. But nationalism has a fatal flaw, that it's unable to tolerate ethnic minorities. The stress on culture, ethnicity, and language mean that those who fit the national profile are likely to have a bad time. And so as nationalism took root in Europe, Jews began to feel increasingly out of step because they had no fatherland or homeland that they could call their own. They were becoming chronically cosmopolitan and an endangered minority, and so they needed to create the State of Israel. And now they've passed that mantle on to the Palestinians, because who are now themselves stateless. And I think if we look at the Golden Rule, don't do to others what you do not like done to yourself, to make them see themselves in each other. They're rather like the brothers, Jacob and Esau in the Bible, who can't live with one another or live without one another. They are now entwined in one another's history. And I think that, remember too, that on both sides, this began as a secular dispute. Religion didn't really enter into it. Zionism was a rebellion against religious Judaism. It felt that Judaism had made Jews too compliant and had encouraged them to just give in to the persecution they experienced, and they felt it was time now to make a stand and become a new kind of Jew. And it shocked the Orthodox at that point. The Orthodox found it blasphemous to use the sacred symbol of Judaism, the Holy Land, in this way. And the Palestinians too the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, was a secular institution. It had to be, because half of the Palestinians in that organization were Christians. And since then, religion, conventional religion, has fused with nationalism, with its inherent inability to tolerate the other, the minority.
Yeah, you know, Ms. Armstrong, as I listen to you and as I've been reading and as I've been researching, I find myself these days agreeing with you spiritually completely on the myth of certainty. As a matter of fact, it's a brilliant book by a friend of mine named Dan Taylor, The Myth of Certainty. But I'm not quite sure I'm on board with you in regards to the myth of religious violence.
Mm-hmm.
When someone says to you, as I might, for example, another way to get to my website is by typing in tohellwithreligion.com. What's your reaction to that statement, to hell with religion?
It seems to me to be as intolerant as the intolerance you attribute to religion. I think that Dawkins and Hitchens and Harris have important things to tell religious people. Because in the past, theologians have conducted very fruitful dialogues with atheists, which helps them to get rid of some of the stupidities that can creep into religion. But it's always been done courteously and with what I would call a Socratic tendency. Socrates made it clear that you could never, that any dialogue, if it was to be fruitful and lead to enlightenment, must be conducted on all sides with courtesy and gentleness, and that everyone should listen respectfully and with open ears and allow themselves to be changed in some degree by the encounter, not to go over to the other side necessarily,
right,
but to feel that you have been changed and have shifted somewhat. We don't have much dialogue like that in the modern world.
No.
It's not enough for us now to seek the truth. We also have to defeat and humiliate our opponents.
Okay, but have you not found that in many ways, religion has gotten in the way of spiritual growth?
Yes, in many ways it does.
I'm not a big incense burning kumbaya kind of guy with the whole, you know, I'm spiritual but not religious thing.
No.
I'm still waffling about in between this,
mm-hmm,
you know, in that no man's land. But I really think that religion has gotten in the way of us knowing the other, knowing God, spiritual growth? I think so.
It certainly can do that if people treat it as a form of nationalism or identify it too strongly. Religion, at its best, is about losing the ego. That does not mean saying I am right. It means, as Einstein said, to be in the presence of what is incomprehensible to us is one of the richest experiences in life. And I think that religion can fall in, you know, religion's an art form, put it this way. It's an attempt, like great art, to find meaning in life. But you can have bad art. It's art is hard to do well. And sometimes people don't do religion well. And they, instead of using it to free themselves of the ego, they want it to make the ego even more so, to back up their identity.
Sure.
That's when you get this kind of... Because once you start blocking the ego and start looking out for your own spiritual experience above all other things, and looking to say that I'm right and everybody else is wrong, this is pure egotism.
Okay, on the phone with Karen Armstrong, what's your soundbite response? Because this is really the crux of a lot of your work. But what's the bumper sticker response, which I know you probably hate soundbites?
Yes, I do.
To all religions are the same.
They are and they're not. All religions, at their best, seek the loss of ego and enlightenment of some sort or another. But because the transcendence they seek is unspeakable and cannot be contained in words, that's what transcendence means, it means that nobody can have the last word. And so there are interesting, fruitful, and significant differences.
Wow. Really well said. And I would expect nothing less from you. Okay, so the golden rule, treat others the way you want to be treated. Apparently, originally, some are saying that came out of Confucius.
Confucius is one of the first people to enunciate the golden rule, do not impose on others which you yourself do not desire, and in a form that was recorded in writing.
Okay.
But I think the fact that it crops up in every single tradition, whether we're talking about China or India or the Middle East or Europe or whatever, shows that it's built into the structure of our humanity.
Okay.
We all recognize empathy when we see it and realize its importance, even though we may not want to be empathic.
Now, of course, I think it's also a nice summary of Judaism in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's jump into love your enemy. Was the original, you know, person behind that Jesus, or did I miss that one?
No, that is Jesus.
Okay.
It is a saying reported of Jesus, which people think may be one of his really authentic sayings. But the word love needs a bit decoding.
Sure.
Because we use the word love in such a sentimental way in the West.
Mm-hmm.
In the ancient Near East, love, chesed, was used in international treaties. Two kings who may have been enemies would promise to love each other, which didn't mean they would fall into each other's arms, but that or that they particularly liked each other, but they would look out for each other's best interests, come to their help practically, even if this went against their short-term interest, and do everything they could to ensure the other's survival.
Okay, so contrasting those two, treat others the way you want to be treated and love your enemy, you know, Ms. Armstrong, which one do you think has the potential to change the world more?
Jesus is not alone in saying that you cannot confine your benevolence to your own group. They all insisted on this, all the traditions. You must have, as one Chinese sage said, yan ai, concern for everybody. And in the book of Leviticus, you honor the stranger, love the foreigner. If a stranger lives with you in your land, do not molest him. You must treat him as one of your own people and love him as yourself, for you were strangers in Egypt, remembering your own pain and alienation when you were a despised minority in Egypt, and don't inflict that on the minorities in your own midst. So they've all said this, Buddhism too, the Jainism too. So that therefore, this is essential for our global world.
Okay, but the problem I have is, well, I have many problems. I mean, I can't do either of those with any sort of consistency. Whether you know, it's treat others the way you want to be treated. You know, love your neighbor. Or love your enemy. I am horrible, horrible, horrible at both of those, which is why I was told that I needed to daily surrender to God so that His Holy Spirit would empower me to enable me to live by these codes. But the love your enemy thing does seem to stand out more than the other.
Well, look, I don't think... I wouldn't recommend submitting to God or...
No, I'm just saying that love your enemy, for me, is harder.
It's harder because that is the great test, but it's the test of our time. Because I think that if we don't treat the people we regard as enemies now, as we would wish to be treated, seeing them as full human beings, we're in danger of repeating some of the tragic mistakes right. of the last century.
Do you have any evangelical friends? Because in the last 5-6 years, I seem to be distancing myself from them more and more as the years go by after my becoming a skeptical believer. Do you have many evangelical friends?
No, I have none at all. Don't forget, I came to this after years of saying I wanted nothing to do with religion ever again.
Yes, yes.
So we don't have many evangelicals in the UK.
No.
we don't have many religious people in the UK. It's a very secular country. Only 6% of the population attend a religious service regularly, and of that, only about most of those are Muslims. I mean, friends actually ask me not to mention my work when I come round for dinner.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting. I sometimes get the same reaction doing what I do. Mm-hmm. You know, you've said that the biblical God is a kind of a starter kit.
Yes.
I bet the Jesus people love that.
I don't care whether people like it or not. But it seems to me that very often we hear about God for the first time at the same time as we're learning about Santa Claus. Mm. And over the years, our view of Santa develops and matures, but our idea of God often gets stuck at an infantile level. And in the past, I've written a history of the Bible. The Bible was read allegorically, and you were expected to take it further. The rabbis were very clear about that, that you every time a Jew confronted the sacred text, it would mean something different. And the idea of reading it in a literal manner did not really come into focus until the late 19th century in the United States.
Okay, so are all religions starter kits, or is there one that you might consider to be the kit you get right after the starter kit?
All of them start the Hebrew Bible that I was talking about. I said the Bible, not religion, is a starter kit.
Yes,
the Bible is a starter kit, and Jews will go on and read it through the lens of the Mishnah and the Talmud, which take it on further.
Okay.
And similarly, the Quran, nobody before the modern period ever read the Quran by itself, always with a mesh of centuries of interpretation, which brought it on further and made people realize the complexity of these issues.
You're saying that all sacred scriptures, no matter what tribe they're from, are starter kits?
Yes.
Okay.
All sacred scriptures are starter kits because we are only stuttering human beings, stuttering before transcendence.
Mm-hmm.
And if we think we've got the last word or we've got it codified down, we've got what we call an idolatry, attributing to a purely a human idea, giving it absolute value. People like Thomas Aquinas, for example, Maimonides, Ibn Sina, would be appalled at the simplistic notions we have about God today. Even though we are technologically and scientifically brilliant, very often our religious ideas get stuck at a rather primitive level.
Okay, chatting with Karen Armstrong, she's just released this latest greatest called Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. You know, Mr. Armstrong, what would you say to Billy Graham after his last appearance on Larry King's show when Larry asked him, you know, his usual question that, you know, Billy, if I don't believe in Jesus, would I go to hell? And Dr. Graham said, all I know, Larry, is that without Jesus, there's no guarantee.
Look, I think that a religion that is centered on the afterlife is a non-starter myself.
Right.
If you're just focused on getting into heaven or escaping hell, as I was as a child, and it completely ruined my religious life, this is no more selfless than paying into your retirement annuity for a comfortable life in the hereafter.
Right.
It's about self. Religion is about the loss of self, not about its eternal survival in optimum conditions. So basically, and I look at what we know about Jesus from what we can sense about him from the Gospels. Here's a man who's continually upsetting the religious establishment, who's continuously reaching out to people who are reviled by the mainstream, who's continuously having dinner with the wrong people, people who are regarded as sinners, breaking down barriers, reaching out, having what the Chinese call yan ai, concern for everybody. Mm-hmm. And I cannot see Jesus, were he here today in today's global world, with all we know about the richness of other traditions, secular or religious, to say mine is the only way.
All right, let's just flash back quick, because I've just... You know, I didn't realize I would have this many questions for you once I had you on our show, and I've just exploded here. So let me fly through this quick. Mother Superior, who was dying, and specifically she asked for you to come back into the room in order to tell you that even though she'd been told that you were going to be a bit of a rat bag, that you were actually a good girl.
Mm-hmm.
But were you a pain?
No, I was just very unhappy and confused.
So you left the convent because, you know, you knew you weren't going to be a good nun.
I knew that, and I also had a breakdown.
Right.
I couldn't do it. I entered, I was a young girl, I was 17.
Yes.
At that age, you don't know what forever means. You are full of idealism, but you're not realistic about life. I mean, someone marrying today at 17...
Yeah.
You is likely to fall into the same trap. But I still don't regret my time in the convent.
Well, no, I mean, you'd been in the convent for 7 years between the ages of 17 and 24. And of course, you know, those are the most explorative years in our lives for the most part. And let alone the fact that those were the same years as the 60s. So not only did you miss your explorative years, you missed the 60s.
Yes.
Have you ever wondered if one of the reasons you're sort of the queen of the kumbaya now, you know, all religions are, you know, they have this similar, you know, the peace and the love, and the, I know that's how some people paint you that way.
Look, I'm not full of peace and love and joy, believe me. if you think that, you've got the wrong idea about me. I'm full of dread.
Right.
I look at what happened in the 1930s and the 1940s. I hear the certainties and the hatred and the way we dismiss other faiths and other people. And I feel we've learned nothing from those decades. And so if I'm in this, I don't think I'm filled with benevolence and kumbaya.
Okay.
I can't stand any of that.
Okay, all right.
I'm filled with a sense of urgency because we've all got a lot to do if we want this world and our species to continue.
Yeah. I was just saddened by the fact that you had never owned a Beatles record and hadn't heard of the Vietnam War.
Yeah, but then what would I have done outside? I'd probably have just been strumming a guitar badly, singing We Shall Overcome.
Oh, that was brilliant. Well said. Okay, so here you are, a nun who can't even get God's attention. You know, you had been taught that God is an all-powerful, anthropomorphic being who tangibly interacts with his creation. You were taught that, quote, God is the supreme spirit who alone exists of himself and is infinite in all perfections. And this is riveting stuff for an 8-year-old to learn.
Yeah, and I now think that's theologically incorrect.
Yeah, okay.
Because God is not these great theologians tell us God is not a being at all, let alone not even the supreme being, because the supreme being is just one something like us, but writ large. As Thomas Aquinas said, God is not another thing. God is not one of the things that exist.
But since you never tangibly encountered this creator in a way that was taught to you by your spiritual teachers, read to you out of the sacred scriptures, and told to you from your peers and their experiences, have you then set about to redefine the undefinable?
Not really. I have no definition of God. And I now can see that the reason I didn't have a spiritual experience was because I had such a primitive conception of the divine.
Right. You know, we all project ourselves onto whichever deity we dig the most. From the Crusades, God wills it, to Benny Hinn, God heals it, to ISIS, God wants me to kill it. You know, what has Karen Armstrong projected onto the deity she digs?
I don't really have a deity. God is just one name for transcendence, and there's no name for the transcendence.
Well, okay, let me finish with some comments from some people I reached out to once they found out you were going to be on my show, Brian McLaren. If you're right, and I think you are, this is Brian McLaren, that compassion is the shared treasure at the center of the world's religions, but if many adherents to the world's religions are more committed to honoring and protecting the treasure chest than the treasure itself, how can we help them shift their commitment?
I don't know. I think we've got to work hard at this in practical ways. And it's what I was saying earlier about egotism. Compassion means dethroning yourself from the center of your world and putting another there. You could only, I think, I created the Charter for Compassion precisely to bring that, make it a reality, a dynamic but practical reality in the 21st century. And that's something that has to be done day by day. As Confucius said, you practice the golden rule all day and every day. Then if you do that, if you leave yourself behind and you experience transcendence.
From Paul Young, who wrote The Shack, when was the last time you discovered that something you believed spiritually you now no longer believe?
Oh, heavens. When? What was the last time?
Yes.
Every day I'm learning something new.
Beautiful.
That's what I do at my study.
Beautiful. That's just a great response. I really, you know, it's amazing how many people I've asked that over the last 12 years of doing the show. And especially in the, I'm sorry, this is going to sound like a cheap shot, but in the evangelical camp, how many people say, oh, no, I've always, I believe the same and this, it's never changed. Really? I don't get it. Religion is not what we study, but what we do. You've said that time and time again. What do you do?
Basically, my study is my prayer, and I use it to make a place for the other, for other people in my mind and heart. And then I'm out on the road talking about it. You're asking me in the middle of a book tour, which I've virtually lost my voice.
I can tell. I'm so sorry.
Talking about these things and trying to get people to realize the urgency of our situation, realize that simplistic ideas about faith or lack of faith will not help us to see rationally and clearly all the predicaments that are tearing our world apart.
The last time a great darkness fell upon you? Whether that be a great sadness, a great grief, a great pain, I mean, how did you spiritually respond?
Oh, yeah. You just go to sleep and just remember that other people, I just remember that I'm living an extraordinarily privileged life. In our cocoon of the Western world, we're living in unbelievable privilege. I just have to turn on the television screen and see the people suffering from Ebola in Africa, to see the refugees in Syria, to realize that I can use my pain to empathize with them and to put my own pain in perspective.
Thank you. I struggle personally with my belief and have for many years now, having found out about you has helped. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And belief is not important.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Okay.
You can land on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Behind these bars of steel and wait for her release. Will she die or will we see Jerusalem?
It's hard to find quality guest speakers these days. If they're interesting, they're usually expensive. And if they're cheap, they're usually boring. Well, here's someone who's both expensive and boring. Drew Marshall is a high school dropout who tried to become a pro football player but didn't make it. He then tried to become a firefighter and didn't make it. Now he's trying to become a stand-up comic. Good luck with that, Mr. Marshall. But if you're looking for someone who's unpredictable, incredibly honest, provocative, genuine, then we've got the right guy. Everyone seems to be an expert on something these days. Why not book someone who's an expert on nothing? except how to be brutally honest about yourself and your faith. To book Drew Marshall as your guest speaker, go to drewmarshall.ca.